Good evening,
and welcome to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio, and it is time for the Heartland Labor Forum, as Judy just said. Judy's on vacation, and I'm in for Jen Zaman. I'm Keith Washburn. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Coalition of Black Trade Unionists and Pipefitters, Local 533. We are union members across the Kansas and Missouri state line, making up the Greater Kansas City Chapter of CBTU, the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. We educate, lead, rally, support our members and the community. We support union-made and workers' rights, but not right-to-work laws. The pipefitter powers the engines of industry that keep business thriving in America. They install, maintain, and service any system that involves air conditioning, heating, chemicals, or refrigeration in residential, commercial, or industrial buildings, as well as high-tech clean rooms. We thank our underwriters for their contributions to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. And now it's time for the news.
Hang on. Ready? This is the news from our side. July 13th, 2017. According to the New York Times, the United Auto Workers have been attempting to organize unions in the auto factories in the South for some time. On Tuesday, July 11th, workers in the Nissan plant in Mississippi filed a petition to organize. This plant of 6,000 wanted to vote within a month. In order to unionize, 30% of the rank and file need to vote in favor of organizing. This would be a major victory for the UAW, as they have worked to organize this area since 2012. The announcement was made during a press conference near the Nissan plant in Canton, Mississippi. This is one of three Nissan facilities worldwide that does not have union representation. In addition, patterns of labor abuses against its predominantly African-American workforce have been identified. Safety concerns have also been reported in this factory. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, has fined the Canton facility a few times within 5 years for safety infractions. The UAW representation can correct these issues by creating safe, stable jobs that offer fair wages and benefits. Charges have been filed against Nissan with the National Labor Relations Board due to violations of labor rights. They have observed Nissan guards keeping workers from distributing union information outside the plant. Nissan claims that their wage of $16.70 per hour is above average in central Mississippi. This wage, however, is much lower than that of Detroit automakers. American automakers pay a veteran worker approximately $30 per hour, and an entry-level employee earns about $20 per hour. Union representation could not only move this inferior pay to wages more comparable to those of the other American auto companies. In addition, the safety problems would be addressed. The workers want the election to take place on July 31st and August 1st.
As St. Louis rolls back its minimum wage increase, workers are scrambling to find a course of action to block what one St. Louis worker described to St. Louis Public Radio's Jason Rosenbaum as a slap in the face. According to most experts, there is little chance that the city can beat the state in a court and overturn this pay cut. Mizzou law professor Richard Rubin told Rosenbaum that one of the only options was to make the argument that this is a municipal issue and that the state should not interfere in it. Another suggestion put forth is for the city to continue to pay minimum wage public workers $10 an hour, which will at least make some positive impact. Kansas City's minimum wage was to go from the state baseline to $8.50 in September and jumping to $13 an hour by 2022. Plus, residents will still get to vote on a separate ordinance in August that would raise the wage to $15 an hour by 2021, even though it can't go into effect.
Some reprieve might be coming to some of Kansas City's most blighted neighborhoods as Governor Greitens signed a bill into law demanding more accountability for absentee landlords. The Kansas City Star editorial board issued a statement in support of the new law. Nearly half of the housing stock in Kansas City is rental, and 3 in 5 African-American families in Kansas City rent. Reports discussed in the Star editorial put Kansas City's vacant properties at a disproportionate level for other comparable cities. Within Kansas City at the beginning of the decade, there were more than 10,000 vacant homes. The Star expressed optimism that the new law would rein in some of the most egregious behavior by absentee landlords by requiring them to provide much more information about the owners of limited liability corporations that buy up property and then neglect it, bringing down the property values of other houses in the neighborhood. The Star pointed out the irony that one of Greitens' more effective moves as governor has added more red tape to small businesses, but beyond petty point scoring about the governor's ideological inconsistency, the law should provide relief to communities forced to live among weed lots and abandoned buildings the government has not done enough to prevent up to this point. The news tonight was read by Molly Madden, Greg Swartz, and myself, Ariana Eckel.
Everything about it is appealing. Everything the traffic will allow. Nowhere could you get that happy feeling when you are stealing that extra bow. There's no people like show people. They smile when they are low. Yesterday they told you you would not go far. That night you open and there you are. Next day on your dressing room they costumes, the scenery, the makeup, the props, the audience that lifts you when you're down. The headaches, the heartaches, the backaches, the flops, the sheriff who escorts you out of town. The opening when your heart beats like a drum. The closing when the customers don't come.
Good evening, and welcome back to a very exclusive Layoffs and Suspensions edition of the Heartland Labor Forum, featuring my alma mater and everyone's favorite local institution of higher learning, UMKC. And I will be your host for the entire two-part special. I'm Tino Scalisi. In this first half, we will be joined live in the studio by faculty and staff of the UMKC Theater Department, Department Chair Tom Mardix. Am I saying that right, Tom?
Correct.
Great. Assistant Professor of Theater and Voice, Mr. Scott Stackhouse. Hi, Scott.
Hi.
And Assisting Teaching Professor of Lighting Technology, Mr. Shane Rose.
Yeah, nice to see you here.
Nice to see you. And so, amid deep budget cuts in state spending for higher education, the University of Missouri system evaluated its Kansas City location's theater department and decided that it no longer needed to continue its successful MFA program or the services of 4 faculty members. So there were layoffs. And these valuable education workers were not fired, but their contracts were not renewed, which, as we all know, amounts to about the same thing. But there's possibly some good news. So first I want to talk to Tom. So I want to give a little brief history of Mr. Mardix as chair. He began teaching at the University of Missouri, Kansas City in 1978 and became head of graduate sound design for UMKC Theater in 1986. And during his tenure as head of graduate sound design, Mardix helped to build the program into one of the most respected sound design programs in the United States. Tom, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
If you could, can you give us a little history about the decision behind making some of these cuts? When it was announced, the decisions behind that, can you talk to us a little bit about that? It's kind of a broad question.
We'd been getting warnings basically since the beginning of the year that, you know, there were going to be cuts. And they were talking in the range of 3 to 6%, okay? And so we're in the College of Arts and Sciences, and so I had, you know, in terms of working budgets, you know, I think we'd theater operated the year that we're closing out on about a $2.7 million budget. And that includes all of our faculty and staff. And then we have a lot of students on fellowships. We have 60 graduate students that are actually employees of the university.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also do productions and then just the regular cost to run a department. And so I was expecting, you know, if it's a 6% cut, I'd sort of calculated that and I was working toward that. And then, you know, we had a meeting with the chancellor and the provost and the dean and the whole faculty, and it was in early April, and they were telling us, you know, how important theater was, and, you know, they wanted us to sort of unpack the budget and see what we could do to raise money and things like that. And they asked us to put the committee together, which we did, four of us, and come up with some ideas, you know, to do, you know, some new things and raise some funds and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And we go into, you know, then the first meeting to discuss this stuff, and there was no discussion of any of the ideas we had. We were given a cut to budget of like $1.9 million. I mean, that is like devastating. And yeah. I mean, I couldn't believe we heard it. And then 2 days later, I got an email and it says, no, it's 1.7. So now that's like $1 million lower than we had. I mean, this is like, you know, and so what happens is we are like an amazingly successful graduate theater program. We are probably, I mean, there is no longer U.S. News, but say our acting program, Hollywood Reporter, just, you know, in the early part of the summer, ranked us as like, you know, like number 17, you know, graduate acting program in the English speaking world. This included England and Australia and Canada, you know. So the other thing is like in terms of ranking and stuff, you know, we're among the highest nationally ranked, you know, at UMKC and in generally in terms of the University of Missouri system, the J school, you know, is number one, you know, and so we're probably like top 10 in terms of theater. So, and you know, we've had tremendous community support in the creating of the MFA program. I mean, it was a partnership with the chancellor and the university leadership in the early 1980s and the Hall Family Foundation that really created the MFA program. And so it was like none of this was making any sense, you know, and we'd gone through already a significant cut because the budget had been like around 2013, around $3 million, and now it's to 2.7. Okay, and now it's going to go to 1.9, and then they said 1.7, then it was back to 1.9, then it was 1.93. And at that point, this faculty met and said, you know, I told everybody, I said, there's only two ways, you know, that this works. One is we have no students, and so the faculty has no one to teach, or we have graduate students and no one to teach them. But in terms of this cut level was so disastrous, I mean, and everything, that, I mean, there's no way. And so basically that's, you know, when I told everybody, I mean, if this goes down, there is no MFA program. It's unsustainable at this level, okay? And so, you know, then the faculty then wrote a letter to the University of Missouri system president. And the thing here is, you know, he's new, okay, he's figuring it out, and he's come into a really bad situation. You know, nothing against the man. I've personally never met him or talked to him, but, you know, I wouldn't want to be in his shoes.
Sure.
But everything that he said, okay, for the programs that were going to be basically held harmless and supported through this major cut, we hit all the markers. In other words, we're strategic. I mean, in terms of the missions and goals of UMKC, it's to excel in the performing arts. That's the conservatory, mm-hmm. and that's the theater department, right. Okay? That's it, okay? Right. And then in terms of community activity, well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I know there are some great programs at UMKC that have a lot of community activity, but we're doing productions at the Unicorn, at the Coterie, at the World War I Museum, at Union Station, and we have students that are doing internships all over. We are so connected. I mean, in our mission, I mean, it's the city is our campus, okay? So we're highly connected there. We have an incredibly talented faculty, and we have really high retention rates and matriculation rates, okay? So the students come in and they get through and they get done on time, both in terms of graduate and undergraduate. And so this made no sense. And so that's what then led us to say, okay, we have to make some noise. Yeah. We have to do something, you know. And so that's kind of what began with this, you know, Save UMKC Theater campaign.
Yeah, so the Save the UMKC Theater campaign, for those of you in the Kansas City listening audience that aren't familiar, I went to one of your events about a month or so ago, and I heard you know, a lot of great arguments from the faculty and staff about why the program should be saved, and I was in complete agreement. And then I was also interested because of the labor perspective, that there were four faculty positions that were going to be cut, and we heard the impassioned speeches, pleas from the people that were going to be affected, mm-hmm. And it was incredibly emotional. A lot of these people are working class people who have families and this sort of thing and responsibilities. And you said something earlier about you wouldn't want to be in the president's shoes. Speaking about being in another man's shoes, I do want to talk to our friend Shane here. I wonder what it would be like being in his shoes. Like, what does it mean to be... he does lighting. Can you tell us a little bit?
Yeah, I do lighting design. And then, well, I've been in Kansas City from since about 1988. And I've worked as in various capacities as a freelance technician. I worked at the American Heartland for a number of years. The American Heartland went out of business about 4 years ago, 3 years ago, and spent some time working at Off Center Theater and Crown Center. That also, you know, due to changes in the structure over there, became a private concern. And so I've been working as a freelancer. You know, but so joining the UMKC faculty was really sort of a logical progression for me from, you know, the career that I've had here in town. You know, when I moved here, I thought I was going to come to Kansas City, hang out for a couple years, get some credits on my resume, and then, you know, move on to another city that was bigger and where there was more going on.
Sure.
I got here and found out that Kansas City is a great town to work in and a great place to do live theater.
Right.
So joining the faculty at UMKC was kind of a logical extension of that, because the relationship between UMKC and the Kansas City theater community is so strong, you know.
Yeah. So when you heard about these cuts, mm-hmm. And that you were going to be one of the people affected, or faculty was going to be affected by this, what was your initial thought?
Well, my initial reaction was a little bit of dismay. Part of it was that, you know, I joined the faculty and really let a lot of my freelance gigs fall to the wayside, and really focused my attention on becoming a part of the UMKC faculty and moving into that role.
Sure.
And so the idea of then, in, you know, fairly short term, having that job go away,
sure.
Meant that I was going to really be dropping back to square one.
Right.
You know, that I was going to have to kind of rebuild the client base that I had let go. You know, and a lot of those jobs, you know, a lot of the work that I'd been doing ended up being taken by graduates of the program.
Sure.
You know, who need to be doing those things.
Yeah.
You know, I kind of felt like I had moved into the next place in.
Well, who
career.
In the hell are they going to have to do it next? So, like, after they right. get, they can't afford the graduate students, then they're going to press people into service after that. They're going to have to round them up in the streets.
Right.
I mean,
well, you know, the small professional theaters where yeah. I've been working as a designer, you know, the gigs that I was doing, you know, those gigs, somebody else started doing them. So, if my job at UMKC goes away, then I've got to start rebuilding,
right.
You know, as a freelancer. So
it's a precarious situation for people working in that program, and for a lot of faculty and staff who work mm-hmm. in other departments at UMKC. And we're here also with Scott Stackhouse, who teaches acting and directing and voice. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for being here. Excuse me. So tell us what you think. I mean, you heard about these cuts at UMKC. What was your initial reaction?
Well, it's tricky because I initially came into the program as kind of head of the undergraduate program. Mm-hmm. And so I worked closely with Tom and the rest of the faculty to really keep that going and to build it up and to make it more unified. And we did a really good job with that. And then as I'm hearing about these cuts, and then when I moved over to voice, we didn't get to fill my position. And so that was one
Your
of the
former
first,
position was?
Yeah, it was tricky because if I hadn't been hired to be voice, then they would have hired someone for voice and I would still be an undergrad. So we would have two people.
Right.
So when I moved over, the plan was that we were going to get a new undergrad person. And then late in the game, that got pulled. And so the undergrad does not have a person. And so I'm still trying to do it. The performance faculty, different members of the faculty are still trying. But it's amazing the immediate impact that has on the students. A lot of students are coming to my office going, so what are we doing now? We don't know what we're doing. And a lot of them need kind of this mentorship to stay focused and stay on target with, because they're always working jobs and trying to do rehearsals and figure out priorities. And so, you know, between once this cuts hit, the undergraduates and the graduates who are here training and ready to move into the profession, everybody's up in arms now, and all of a sudden, you know, there's a lot of unrest. And, you know, over this summer, we're still in contact with students, and they're constantly, well, what's going on? Are we going to have a program? Are we going to have something to do?
Sure.
And
because this is a program they've already enrolled in. They've already been...
Well, they've changed their life to get here.
Sure.
I mean, they've you know, let offers go to other schools. They've moved. Their families have made sacrifices, and some of them are just beginning. We have a first-year class of actors this year. Who are just beginning, and then, you know, towards the end of their first year, they're told, well, we'll just see if we have a program, we're working on it. And there's a lot of unrest. And at the end of the day, when we're in the classroom, we just want to keep the focus on what we're supposed to be doing. And this is such a distraction. It's really disheartening to watch. And also not to be able to say, look, it's going to be okay. Because, well, we just aren't sure about that yet.
Sure.
We don't make false promises.
And so when you think about the downward pressure from UMKC administration in getting your budgets under control, and from what I understand from you gentlemen in the numbers that Tom was talking about earlier, it sounds like it's already things are already very efficient, things are already very tight. And so to imagine that even further cuts are being expected, what sort of pressure does that put on you as an assisting professor to perform, like you were saying earlier, about having to do the work now possibly of trying to figure out a way to get this valuable work done?
Well, you know, I'm not into complaining.
No.
But the problem that comes up is just a logistical problem of time.
Sure.
Because you have a certain number of students that you're responsible for. If you don't provide them with productions, that is the actual lab work of the work in classroom. Mm-hmm. And so then if you don't have the money to bring in people to do productions, then you have to do them yourself, which takes on all those extra hours. To do a production, to direct, if one of us just decide, well, you know what, we're going to direct the production because we don't have the budget to get somebody, that is for 6 to 8 weeks for sure while you're in rehearsal, an entirely second job. That's a whole another 40-hour a week job.
Wow.
Okay.
I mean, within, you know, the department, you know, we calculate, we teach classes, and we have to teach small classes. I mean, you can't have like 40 kids in an acting class. We limit acting classes to like 12, and some of our graduate courses are 5, 6, sometimes 3. But you know what we get into if everything just starts sort of falling apart. Right now, we have a faculty that truly believes in the program, and we have people that have come to Kansas City that have taken their positions here 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And they've done it because we have such a great program. We have the Kansas City Repertory Theater, you know, is our professional theater that we share with.
Uh-huh.
And then we do all of these theater projects then with small professional theaters in the city. And just like the campaign and putting on the event that we did in Spencer Theater, was a lot of effort, and faculty, it was faculty that put it all together and put it all on. And it was at a time when everybody's off work.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
I mean, it was semester was over and it was done. So we spent 8 weeks working on that. Okay. So what happens if all this goes on? I mean, the program begins to decline. Well, you're going to have a few people that aren't really wanting to retire who will, and then we won't get those positions. Yeah. But you're talking about really like world-class teaching artists. And don't think for a minute that our program is the kind of program that, you know, we have a kid that gets an MFA, you know, and then the next year we're hiring somebody to come in here with a new MFA to teach in our program. No, that's not what we do at all. I mean, we get people that have worked professionally for 10 or 15 years, and now they want to give back. Okay? So we have, right now, we have probably about 8 people that are like tenured professors that could retire if they wanted. Okay? And then we have young people that are in the beginning of their academic career, like Scott Stackhouse or Carla Nowak or, you know, Stephanie Roberts, who are sort of what we would say mid-career professionals, but they're also in the early end of the teaching spectrum. Well, what happens if it all starts going apart? Then we become, unfortunately, like some other departments. You know, there are very few departments in the university that are as unified and as focused, you know, and committed to the students and to the programs that we're doing as theater is.
Yeah.
Okay? And so I say, well, heck with this. I'm just going to do my own projects. Okay? No, I can't help with that. No, I don't want to direct that. No, I'm not going to teach that class anymore.
Sure.
I don't have to.
Right.
Okay? And so I'm just going to go do my own projects. So everybody, you know, what happens is people either leave or people become sort of selfish, and they basically say, it's not going to be what we were here for. I have to do something different.
Sure.
You know?
And that makes sense. And what you were talking about the department falling apart, and I think that we've got about another, Keith, what do we got, another few minutes here? I do want to talk about the thing you were mentioning earlier about the department falling apart and then the effect on the students and the students who are coming here for the MFA program, and if it is disintegrating or there's a threat of it possibly disintegrating in the future. And their reaction towards that. I was talking to other faculty of a different department for something that I did earlier, and they mentioned something about student evaluations and how student evaluations could be a measure of whether or not the faculty is invited back, especially if they're non-tenure or tenure-track faculty. Is there a concern about that?
Well, as a chair, you know, I read through student evaluations. I take them with a grain of salt. I don't look so much at what they check off and stuff.
Yeah.
What I will do is I like to read their comments, because then, I mean, you're getting a really like strong opinion and things like that.
Sure. I was horrified when my adjunct faculty professor of journalism at UMKC actually asked for my student evaluation. I'm like, what do you mean? I mean, you're my professor. Like, what the hell difference does it make? He was good at what he did, and like to think that my evaluation could somehow negatively impact whether or not he's going to get the contract, Scott.
Hey, my first year at UCLA, when I was a grad student, our movement teacher hijacked our class's evaluations.
I would.
And then we caught him in it, and then he faked a breakdown. Now that was awesome.
That's theater.
We're not doing that.
Right.
But see, the thing is, you know, I think we're in a world, it's too much. You know, we will teach things and have students do stuff.
Yeah.
And they may do stuff for like a couple years.
Yeah.
And they may not like what they're doing.
Yeah.
And they may not, it may take them a year or two for them to understand what they're doing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And when you become a really experienced teacher and educator, but really what we are, we're mentors. I mean, very few of us, only Felicia Landre actually does bona fide lectures, with Gene Friedman in History of Design and Technology.
Uh-huh.
The rest of us are working with the students, just like we're sitting around the table here, talking, showing things, letting them try it and testing and stuff like that out.
So how do we remove the financial pressure? I know that
we need a different mindset for administrators.
Okay.
Okay, the administration at UMKC since 2008, it's all focused on cuts, 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 cuts.
Sure.
Managing cuts.
Yeah.
We have a whole, we have like 11 or 12 different deans, you know, I can't keep track, you know, and all these deans and stuff, you know, it's like deal with cuts. What we need is an administration that does what their job really is supposed to be, which is to supply the academic mission with the resources necessary to do what we're doing. Mm-hmm. They haven't been doing, in my opinion, they haven't been doing their jobs. And just managing a budget, that's not the sum total of the thing.
Right.
And so we need more out of them. And we don't need to hire more. We don't need to pay them more. We just need the ones that we have to do what they're supposed to do. And sure. That's my view.
Sure. Does anyone have any closing thoughts, Shane? Did you want to say something or add something?
Well, I was going to comment on something Tom was saying a minute ago. You know, it's just that as, you know, someone who is at the beginning of an academic career, I'm spending a lot of my time really trying to find my way into that, and I was going to reiterate what he was saying about, you know, the lecture thing. You know, I do spend some time in classes doing lectures. I have some sessions that I've prepared where I, you know, go through a specific lecture. But what I really do is much more akin to coaching. You know, a lighting crew for theatrical production is very much like a football team.
Right.
You have different people in different roles, and you're trying to train them on how to function in those roles and how they, you know, and what step of the process they step in and take their place. You know?
Well, I wish you guys the best of luck in the future of the department and all of the labor that the department depends on, and the UMKC depends on, the Kansas City community depends on to put on these big productions. Scott, do you have any information that people in Kansas City, if they want to support the UMKC theater program, what they might be able to do? How can the community help out?
Well, I think if you know, we're on Facebook, you can, there's lots of contacts, ways to get a hold of us in terms of emails and whatnot. We've made ourselves pretty available over these last few months. And we're always looking for help, but we're pretty plugged in to a lot of the community.
Yeah.
And we try to stay in contact with them. So we're always looking for help. And I think, you know, we're really appreciative of what the community has shown when we showed that we really needed some support. They really
sure.
came out. So now it's really just it's a little bit of a waiting game to see how these chips are going to fall.
And is there a meeting coming up? Do we know anything about that? Is there
nothing particularly scheduled? There are a couple of things that are going on. The ball's in the administration's court.
Good.
The one thing I would say though is it's like mid-August, students start coming back, mm-hmm. and so, you know,
that's
depending upon
really
where things
tell.
Are going and.
Yeah.
You know, that's when they're going to be sort of there. And, you know, that's sort of like the old elephant charge. You know, they're great troops,
they're
these
back.
Elephants for you. But when
right.
you say charge, you never know which way they're going to go. And so, you know, students will be students, and they're going to make some demands. And it's actually not just theater students. I mean, it also is spread into, like, the art, you know, department and pharmacy and – you know, at one point, I know economic students were, you know, upset.
And
so.
On the second half of the show, which we need to start, also labor program at UMKC has been suspended.
It's unbelievable.
So
I can't
talk
believe
about that
it's
too
happened.
Soon. And so the Facebook page we have, it's Save UMKC Theater?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For joining us.
Thanks so
guys.
Much.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
But you gotta be moved in time.
All right, one more time. Pick it up where you left it off.
Road must have a code that you can live by.
just a goodbye.
Now sing.
Teach your children well. Their father's hell will slowly go by. And feed them on your dreams. The one they fix, the one you'll know by. Don't you ever ask them why. If I told you, you would cry. So just look at them and sigh. And know they love you. And you,
can you hear
tender years?
Do you care?
You can't know the fears.
Can you see
that your elders grew by?
And thank you for returning to the Heartland Labor Forum for this second half. We're going to hear from Judy Ansel. She's the director of the program you're hearing today and that you have enjoyed for the past 25 years. But she's also the director of the Workers' Education and Labor Studies Program at UMKC, formerly the Institute for Labor Studies. And if you are hearing this now, it is my duty to inform you, our listening audience, that the Workers' Education and Labor Studies Program has been suspended by the administration of the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and it has laid off its director, Judy Ansel. Here's my interview with Judy Ansel. And we're here back on the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm in the studio with Judy Ansel, the director for the Workers' Education and Labor Studies Program at UMKC, a program that's been recently suspended by UMKC administration. It was formerly known as the Institute for Labor Studies. And by the way, I'm Tino Scalisi. I am a program volunteer on the Heartland Labor Forum and a former student of the Institute for Labor Studies program. I graduated in 2002. And I want to talk with Judy a little bit about, you know, what a labor studies program is. From 1985 to 1986, the program was headed up by Walter Pearson of SEIU Local 1, and it was a partnership between Longview Community College, UMKC, and the Labor Beacon. Judy, what is a labor education program?
A labor education program, and it's great to do this, Tina.
Thank you.
A labor education program is a program which aims at teaching union members and the public about unions, how they operate, how to be leaders in unions, how to represent workers, labor history, and bargaining. And it's aimed at professionalizing labor so that union leaders can meet on a level playing field with management. And it really wears two hats, because it wears the university hat of teaching regular university students about labor and about careers in not just labor but social change.
Right.
And it also does training out in the labor community for union leaders and future union leaders to do a better job in their roles in the economy.
And that's kind of what I wanted to talk about. In the nearly 30 years that you've directed the program, can you tell me what sort of activities, you mentioned the academic part of it and then being in the community, can you tell me like specifically what sort of projects and initiatives that you've been involved in? I know that you could probably go on for...
Probably for a long time.
Probably for a very long time. And I could probably, just being a student and a program volunteer, I could probably go on for a long time as well. But can you tell me what sort of activities specifically that the program has carried out over the past 30 years? Can you give me an example?
Yeah, well, okay. So one of the most typical things I would do as the director would be to go into unions, often on a Saturday, mm-hmm. and do a shop steward training.
Okay.
And they
a
would
shop
have
steward training. What
yeah.
Is it?
So the union representatives, you guys in the UAW, call them committeemen.
Mm-hmm.
In most unions, they call them stewards. They're the front line of the union. They're the rank and filers who are empowered by the union to represent the workers and to deal with the workers' problems and deal with problems that come up with a collective bargaining agreement. So I would do training on how to do that representation, how to argue a case, how to investigate a case, what your rights are as a steward, because they're different from your rights as a worker.
Okay.
And so how to meet with unions in order to be able to win some justice in the workplace for the workers. That's one kind of activity
okay.
that we've done over the years, you know, over and over and over again
sure.
for many different kinds of unions. Unions in the building trades, unions in factories, public sector unions, all kinds. Starting in 1998, we got funding from the system, UMKC system, to start a certificate program in labor studies, which involved credit courses at the university, which aimed in preparing leaders for the future. So okay. you were one of those students who came in early on in that program and took a series of six courses, giving you a background in labor, and I bet you can't even remember what the courses were.
I remember every single one of those courses are.
Do you
I
really?
Can tell
okay.
you in detail.
Yeah, and this was a joint program with University of Missouri-St. Louis and University of Missouri-Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
We used the university's interactive video network, and so
right.
we were on TV,
uh-huh.
and you know, we could see our students who were in the remote locations.
Sure, yeah, I remember.
And
that.
We brought them together across the state
yeah.
to get to know each other and to learn how to bargain and all those different things.
And if I could say a word about being in those classes, I remember. When I started working at the Ford Motor Company in 1999, I can remember feeling like, you know, here I was starting my career. What at the time didn't very much seem like a career. It seemed like, oh, this is this dead end sort of a thing. And then very, very shortly after I began working at Ford Motor Company, I started getting involved in the union, got involved in the education committee at UAW Local 249. And then very quickly learned about the labor education program at UMKC that Judy taught, and it was in these classes that I would still very often be in my coveralls. I would still very often be
right
dirty
off the assembly line,
right fresh off the assembly line, just scattering like right from the assembly line right to the classroom, and I would get to hear these, For example, in labor history courses, I would learn a lot about the UAW and learn a lot about what working people, regular working people, did on a daily basis to come together collectively to fight for better working conditions.
So that you had education benefits that paid for your classes.
I absolutely did. And thank
a victory.
You to Ford Motor Company,
yes.
negotiated by the UAW to get these classes. And so I can't imagine that a program as instructive as it was and as transformative as a program as it was, that it's now in jeopardy. What do we know now from UMKC administration about the future of the labor program?
Well, in May, I was told that they, as a result of massive budget cuts that came down from our state legislature, which is, in my opinion, gradually trying to privatize higher education in the state of Missouri by cutting budgets year after year. And this year's budget cuts were really draconian. And so UMKC had to look at what they were going to cut. The fact is, there wasn't a lot of fat. If you don't count the administrators, which have been growing every year,
mm-hmm.
With many with six-figure salaries,
interesting.
And those folks aren't going to get cut. And so they started looking at programs. And they told me that because the labor studies program didn't have, in their opinion, enough students, even
mm-hmm.
though we offered two courses a semester, and this last academic year, we had 78 students take those courses, and
oh,
the
wow.
year before, we had 82, but that wasn't enough.
Interesting.
And so they said there weren't enough students actually pursuing their certificate, and so they said they were cutting the program. They were going to suspend the program, and they were laying me off. Well, my own view is the way they measured that and the way they looked at the value of this program was completely driven by dollars of warm bodies in the classroom.
Sure.
And
sure.
not about the importance to the community, not about balance in the curriculum. I mean, the business school has 64 faculty.
That's what
Labor
I was
education
ask you. Sure.
had one. And who did they cut?
And so do you think that when they were looking at certain programs to cut, how do you think that they came to the decision to cut labor studies as
it's
opposed
pure
to
speculation?
Well,
As opposed to theater, they cut the theater too, right?
Yeah, no,
Yeah, okay, so they have this concept of sort of the basic meat and potatoes of a college curriculum,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is your English courses, your science courses, your economics, the fundamental required curriculum. And so they don't want to cut those.
Right.
And so they start looking at the extras, the things that aren't part of their core mission. So they get to theater and they get to labor studies, and I've heard they're cutting from ESL, English as a Second Language, and I don't know what all they're cutting.
And strangely,
they haven't really said who all is getting the axe.
And strangely, you would think that because a lot of students who are enrolled at UMKC are very often, you know, from working class families, are very often workers themselves. You would think that these courses would be beneficial to the students in the community. It would seem strange that they would cut labor studies as opposed to something else. Not that you want them to cut anything else, obviously.
Right.
As
I mentioned, there's a lot of six-figure salaries there of administrators who have been hired in the last 10, 15 years.
Hmm. For anybody who's listening to the program, if they want to see the labor studies program continue, if that's even a possibility, I don't even know if they're considering that.
Everything's possible.
Okay, because it hasn't happened yet. The program has been suspended. You've been laid off. The program is absolutely in jeopardy. But if somebody wants to get involved and wants to help save the labor studies program, what can they do?
Well, they can certainly indicate their support of the program by calling the university, calling the chancellor's office,
mm-hmm.
and letting them know that they want to see the program continue. They can write letters to the editor
mm-hmm.
of the Star.
Sure.
They can write the university. And those are the main things at this point. I mean, our labor community is quite upset about these cuts and is pushing back. But, you know, talk about kicking them while they're down. I mean, the labor community is also fighting right to work, is fighting a legislature that's incredibly hostile to labor and trying to pull the rug out from under the abilities of organized labor to represent its members politically by, you know, like with bills that attack public employee unions, cutting prevailing wage, cutting workers' compensation. They've just suspended the right to have project labor agreements on construction jobs.
Sure.
All sorts of anti-union. The whole agenda of the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, is being put into effect in Missouri, or they're trying to.
Wow.
And now that we have a governor who's willing to sign those bills, labor has a tremendous fight on its hands. And so, you know, what do you do? You know, what's your priority?
Sure.
You know, what do you fight for, and can you fight for everything, is a real question. That's why we need outside support.
So do you have any sort of closing arguments or closing, not arguments? Do you sound like I'm in
court? Well, you know, I mean, it's not just that we provide these kinds of classes.
Yeah.
You know, we produce the radio show here on KKFI,
which
is an attempt to reach out to the community. I have done a tremendous amount of public speaking in schools, with community organizations. I mean, various projects we've done over the years. We did the labor history tour of Kansas City. I've researched and learned about global economy issues, particularly in Latin America, taken students on trips down to Mexico and Honduras. There's a lot of things that affect the community at large that don't just affect union members or students, regular students. And so, you know, the suspension or, you know, canceling of the program will have wider ramifications in terms of, you know, bringing a dialogue and information into the community about the importance of work and workers and what workers' rights are that will really be lost. I mean, one of the things is that there aren't many people in Kansas City who are experts from the union side, from the labor side.
Sure.
And, you know, I routinely get called by the media for a balancing opinion on some business story or labor story.
Sure, of course.
And, you know, that won't be there anymore either.
And sadly, I mean, for students who are interested in labor studies programs, I mean, they're going to have to go to what? To New York? Or they're going to have to go to...
There's online programs offered by the University of Illinois, University of Indiana. Maybe they could take those.
Yeah.
There's unions provide some training.
Right.
we provide education and not just training.
Right.
I mean, we're not just doing skills training. I mean, we try to help people understand how the economy works for labor.
Sure.
You know, what lessons our history teaches us about how we improve jobs in this country and how we got a middle class. All of those things are part of the labor education that was provided through the UMKC program.
And everything that I know, to the limited extent that I do know it, is all because of the labor studies program and because of your instruction, Judy, and the support that I got from students and other activists that I've met in the community.
And there were other teachers in the program.
Absolutely,
too.
Absolutely, yeah. Paul Rainsberger and there Don Gilgem, and there were others from UM St. Louis and Columbia, and hopefully this program will continue on. But it won't continue on without a fight. And so thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Good evening and welcome to Remember Our Struggle. I'm Ariana Eckel. How it could have happened in a civilized country, I'll never know. This is the only country it could have happened in. As far as we're concerned, we're still on strike. Fred Watson. The Bisbee deportation was still fresh in Fred Watson's mind when interviewed 60 years later. On July 12, 1917, Watson and 1,185 other men were herded into filthy boxcars by an armed vigilante force in Bisbee, Arizona, and abandoned across the New Mexico border. Arizona in the early 1900s was home to huge copper mining operations. During World War I, the price of copper reached unprecedented heights, and the companies reaped enormous profits. By March of 1917, copper sold for 37 cents a pound. It had been only 13.5 cents at the outbreak of World War I 3 years earlier. With 5,000 miners working around the clock, Bisbee was booming. The mining companies controlled Bisbee not only because they were the primary employers, but also because local businesses depended heavily on the mines and the miners to survive. Prior to 1917, union activity had repeatedly been stifled. Between 1906 and 1907, for example, about 1,200 men were fired for supporting a union. Finally, in 1916, the International Union of Mine, Mill, and Smelter, formerly the Western Federation of Miners, successfully enrolled 1,800 miners. The Industrial Workers of the World, IWW, presence in Arizona was also increasing. Some of the IWW's tactics, such as advocating slowdowns and sabotage, were of great concern to the controlling interests. They also actively recruited miners from minority groups. The IWW was particularly successful recruiting Bisbee's Mexican workers, who were routinely given lower-paying jobs outside of the mine. The IWW was also successful recruiting Southern European immigrants who were allowed in the mines but given lower-paying jobs. On June 24, 1917, the IWW presented the Bisbee Mining Companies with a list of demands. These demands included improvements to safety and working conditions, such as requiring two men on every machine and an end to blasting in the mines during shifts. Demands were also made to end discrimination against members of labor organizations and the unequal treatment of foreign and minority workers. Furthermore, the unions wanted a flat wage system to replace sliding scales tied to the market price of copper. The copper companies refused all the IWW demands, using the war effort as justification. As a result, a strike was called, and by June 27th, roughly half of the Bisbee workforce was on strike. Tensions heightened when rumors spread, asserting that weapons and dynamites were cached around Bisbee for sabotage. A group of miners loyal to the mining companies formed the Workmen's Loyalty League. On July 11th, secret meetings of this vigilante group were held to discuss ways to deal with the strike and the strikers. The next day, starting at 2 a.m., calls were made to loyalty leaguers as far away as Douglas, Arizona. By 5 a.m., around 2,000 deputies had been assembled. All wore white armbands to distinguish them from the other miners. The Western Union Telegraph Office was seized, preventing any communication to the town. At 6:30 a.m., Sheriff Harry Wheeler gave orders to begin the roundup. Throughout Bisbee, men were roused from their beds, their houses, and the streets. Though armed, the vigilantes were instructed to avoid violence. However, reports of beatings, robbery, vandalism, and abuse of women later surfaced. The vigilantes rounded up over 1,000 men, many of whom were not strikers, or even miners, and marched them 2 miles to the Warren Ballpark. There they were surrounded by armed loyalty leaguers and urged to quit the strike. Anyone willing to put on a white armband was released. At 11 a.m., a train arrived, and 1,186 men were loaded aboard boxcars inches deep in manure. Also boarding were 186 armed guards. A machine gun was mounted on the top of the train. The train traveled from Bisbee to Columbus, New Mexico, where it was turned back because there were no accommodations for so many men. On its return trip, the train stopped at Hermanos, New Mexico, where the men were abandoned. A later train brought food and water rations, but the men were left without shelter until July 14th when U.S. troops arrived. The troops escorted the men to facilities in Columbus. Many were detained for several months. Meanwhile, Bisbee authorities mounted guards on all roads into town to ensure that no deportees returned and to prevent new troublemakers from entering. Several months after the deportation, President Woodrow Wilson set up the Federal Mediation Commission to investigate the Bisbee deportation. The commission discovered that no federal law applied. It referred the issue to the state of Arizona while recommending that such events be made criminal by federal statute. The state of Arizona took no action against the copper companies. Approximately 300 deportees brought civil suits against the El Paso and Southwestern Railroad and the copper companies. None of these suits came to trial because of out-of-court settlements. Suits were also filed in state court against 224 vigilantes. Sadly, the only suit brought to trial ended in a not guilty verdict. The rest of the cases were dismissed. Adapted from a University of Arizona web exhibit. Thank you for listening, and here comes the calendar.
Okay. Heartland Labor Forum calendar, July 13, 2017. The Coalition of Black Trade Unionists and the A. Philip Randolph Institute Community Health and Awareness Fair. That's Saturday, July 15th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. The Laborers Union, 7820 Prospect Avenue, Kansas City, Missouri. Midwest School for Women Workers, Sunday, July 16th and Thursday, July 20th. Register at midwestwomenworkers.org. SEIU Healthcare Demonstration to support a fair contract, Thursday, July 20th, 2 to 4 p.m. at Research Hospital. Check out the Heartland Labor Forum schedule on the web at www.heartlandlaborforum.org, where you can also listen to today's show. Like us on Facebook, or just search for Heartland Labor Forum.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.